Case number 243395, Albert Pickett, Jr. et al. Versus the City of Cleveland, Ohio. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Redinger, you may proceed for the appellant.
May it please the court, Mike Redinger representing the appellant, the City of Cleveland, Ohio. Judge Clay, we've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Your Honors, the district court erred when it based its class certification order on a finding that the mere assessment of a water lien makes housing unavailable within the meaning of Section 3604A of the Fair Housing Act. It then compounded that error when it treated that alleged statutory violation as conclusive of the Rule 23B3 predominance factors, even though for many members of the water lien class, the assessment of a lien never leads to an injury such as penalties, interests, or a foreclosure.
Let me ask you this. The determination of, you say by the district court that housing is unavailable, doesn't that go to the merits of the dispute such that that issue doesn't have to be adjudicated in connection with deciding the viability of a class action here?
I would agree with you that it is a question of law that is a merits issue, but that it's appropriate for review under the Rule 23F appeal that this case is on interlocutory appeal from, because that, what I call a scope issue of the application of the statute, is the basis under which the trial court certified the 23B3 class, because it said is that fact, the same assessment that it finds makes housing unavailable under the Act, was also the factor that it found conclusive of the predominance inquiry under the B3 factors, such that it did not need to consider whether there were individualized fact of injury questions, such as whether water lien member class participants incurred penalties, interests, or actually experienced a foreclosure.
All right, but issue doesn't have to be finally determined at this class certification stage, does it?
The issue of the application of Section 3604A does need to be determined in order to determine whether the district court erred in making its predominance conclusion, because it relied on that, what I've called a scope issue, as the foundation for the predominance portion of the issue. And it's generally accepted in this court's law, the In Re Delta Airlines case is one of them, that accepts that where there's a underlying question of law that supports the 23B3 analysis, that question of law needs to be resolved and resolved under a de novo standard.
Is it a question of law or a question of fact of whether this affects the availability of housing? And if it's a question of fact, would you'd have a trial before you have a certification of the class?
I would call it a question of law, Your Honor, and the reason is because it necessarily brings into question what this court meant in the Babin case when it interpreted the same otherwise makes unavailable language. They're under 3604F.
How do we know whether it makes housing unavailable unless we have the facts of City of Cleveland presented? I mean, how do we decide that as a matter of law?
We know this, Your Honor, because between the Babin case and the Cisneros case, this court has set out markers for what it means for something, what actions fall within that otherwise make unavailable language. And what it said is it has to have a direct effect. What does it have to have a direct effect under? If you look at Babin, Babin says that there are certain acts that are too attenuated from interference with possession or dispossession to qualify under that language. If you look at Cisneros, it says there are certain acts like discriminatory lending or racial steering that have an immediate effect on possession. And between those two emerges a rule, which is that for an act to make housing unavailable, it needs to dispossess or interfere with possession. It is undisputed that liens of the kind that Cleveland Water institutes, which are statutory liens, do not give any ownership interest in a property. They do not interfere with possession. Like the District of Vermont case, the Haar case, discussed in our briefs, Your Honor, that was an electric utility lien case, unlike a water lien. The court said it doesn't do anything to interfere with the use, enjoyment of property. All a statutory lien does, it is a creation of the Ohio General Assembly to solve a problem, the problem of nonpayment of utility bills. What do you do when that happens? The General Assembly decided that the solution to that problem is to allow utilities to certify what is functionally a security interest so that that balance will one day be paid from the property if a series of things occur. That's if the property is ever sold. It may be years down the line. In some cases, it may never occur.
So in Ohio, they cannot foreclose on a lien? Say the lien is not paid and it goes for years, the city of Cleveland can't foreclose and get property based on the lien? Is that Ohio law?
To be clear, the city of Cleveland cannot foreclose on a lien itself. That's in the record, both from the deposition of one of the city of Cleveland's 30B deponents, Karen Mustin Robinson, and also plaintiff's expert Justin Steele conceded that during his deposition. Now, I'm not saying that a lien can never at some day lead to a foreclosure, but the mechanism by which that would happen is that Cuyahoga County, in which Cleveland sits, Cleveland Water certifies the lien as a security interest against the property. It is placed under the relevant statute on the tax duplicate real property list. That same real property list also accumulates any other liens that are from various utilities or, for example, real property tax liens that aren't paid. Cuyahoga County may at some point in the future determine to foreclose on the property due to the amalgamation of liens that will have accumulated.
Does that affect the availability of housing then, with the foreclosure of liens?
I would agree that a foreclosure would affect the availability of housing. But if you look at this court's holding under Babin, when they talked about what acts are sufficiently, between Babin and Cisneros, what acts are sufficiently immediate to affect the availability of housing, there is nothing immediate about the assessment of a water lien that contributes to housing unavailability, because we know it may not occur at all. It may only occur after years. And there is nothing in the record that has ever attempted to parse out, none of plaintiff's experts looked at this, what the actual increased risk traceable to a specific water lien assessment has on that. When we look, for example, the named plaintiff, Albert Pickett, is a great example. This was discussed in the expert report provided by defendants by Martha Corshane, which is in the record. She looked at and attempted to parse out what causal impact, if any, water lien certification might have had on housing unavailability. I said earlier, Judge Griffin, that when Cuyahoga County decides to foreclose, they look at the amalgamation of liens and debt burdens on the property before they decide it. Ms. Corshane looked at that and said the percentage of Mr. Pickett's overall encumbrance on the property was only about 6.2% attributable to water liens. The remaining 93.8% was related to other debts. So that the water lien, no one has ever been able to look and see that relatively marginal portion attributable to a water lien assessment actually makes housing unavailable.
Well, don't we have the problem that at this stage of the litigation, we're not trying to decide if the FHA has been violated. That would go to the merits, and that issue would be addressed or developed in discovery as the case goes forward. But rather, we're trying to decide whether the requirements of Rule 23 are met with regard to the requirements for class action. So this is all very preliminary. We're at the preliminary stage of this action. So if we view things in that context, our inquiry is somewhat limited, is it not?
In this context, Your Honor, I respectfully don't agree. And the reason I don't agree is I agree with you that there's no determination yet that the Fair Housing Act has been violated. But before we answer the question of whether this is even a Fair Housing Act case, you have to consider whether or not the act being challenged made housing unavailable under 3604A. If it doesn't, this isn't a Fair Housing Act case.
Well, no, we don't have to decide that. We have to decide if the allegations maybe have initially stated a claim or a cause of action, but then we look to see if questions of law and fact, if there are questions of law and fact common to the class members such that there's those common issues of law and fact predominate over the interests of the individual members who would constitute the class. And if that's so, we would say that the district judge has appropriately ascertained that there's that the requirements for class action certification are met. That's what we're trying to do at this juncture, not delve into determining the merits of the matter.
So this is where the scope and predominance issues intermingle in a way that becomes confusing. Because when the district court certified the damages class under Rule 23b-3, in his predominance analysis, the district court judge said that it is the assessment of the lien, not any penalties, interests, ultimate foreclosures, or financial consequences that might accompany the lien at a later date. The assessment of the lien is the act both that makes this a Fair Housing Act case and that gives rise to damages. And that's where the predominance error here becomes into play. Because what the district court essentially said is that lien assessment, which makes this a Fair Housing Act case, that is all I need to look at for determining that certification of a damages class is appropriate. And that is inconsistent with what the Supreme Court has said in the TransUnion versus Ramirez case, where TransUnion discussed, can a statutory violation, an alleged statutory violation, support the predominance element of that? So the district courts...
I don't think that's true. I don't think that statement you just made is true as a matter of law, in as much as the TransUnion case doesn't govern here because it addresses class member standing in the limited context of recovering damages, and it declined to address the distinct question of whether every class member must demonstrate standing before the court certifies a class. In other words, we're way removed from what happened in TransUnion, which was would occur down the road if this case proceeds, which is we'll get to the issue of damage, or the district court will get to the issue of damages much later, and that's what TransUnion addressed. So that is not really applicable here.
Your Honor, I'm over my time. May I answer your question?
Yeah.
The reason TransUnion is applicable, and I agree with you, Judge Clay, that it is a standing case, but in determining whether or not the class members in TransUnion had standing, the court had to answer the question of how do we define injury in a case where the alleged injury is a violation of a federal statute. And when in doing that, in giving that answer to how you define injury, that portion of TransUnion is directly relevant here because it essentially said, if you are going to try to satisfy class-wide damages by pointing to violation of a federal statute, you have to do one of two things. You have to show that that is a harm that Congress explicitly elevated, or you have to show that it is analogous to some sort of common law injury. In TransUnion, it was analogous to a defamation action. There's nothing in the record or analysis here that the court did that. And if that's the case and it's relying only on the statutory violation, our position is that is not sufficient to meet predominance.
But if the FHA is violated, the plaintiffs who had the statute, the FHA was violated to the statute, those plaintiffs, they do have standing, don't they, for the FHA violation?
Our position, Judge Griffin, is that they have standing if they can prove an injury traceable to that violation of the Fair Housing Act.
Right.
In the instance of plaintiffs who experienced a foreclosure...
If there is a violation of the Fair Housing Act, there is standing.
Right. No, Your Honor. If there is a violation of the Fair Housing Act and injuries traceable to that, such as penalties, interests, or a subsequent foreclosure, there would be standing.
The violation of the FHA itself doesn't give them standing?
Correct. Just like in TransUnion, the violation...
I thought it did. I mean, I thought the FHA actually itself gave standing, but I thought there was some case law about that, but am I wrong?
Your Honor, I am not aware of any case law that creates FHA standing for an injury based simply on that. I think this is more analogous to the Fair Credit Reporting Act in TransUnion, where the violation alone has to have a concrete injury as well. And the failure to do that fact of injury analysis could predominate over common class-wide issues. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Let's hear from your opposing counsel.
Good Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jennifer Holmes for Plaintiff's Appellees. As the Supreme Court instructed in Amgen, the purpose of class certification is not to adjudicate the case, but is to select the method best suited for adjudication. The District Court did not abuse its discretion here when it held that plaintiff's proposed method, a Waterlain B3 class, satisfied Rule 23's requirements, including predominance. Common issues predominate here because every step of evaluating plaintiff's Fair Housing Act claim uses the same analysis and relies on the same evidence across the class. This is a disparate impact claim, and as the Court knows, that uses a burden-shifting framework where the plaintiffs identify a policy that has a disparity, the defendants can put forth a justification for the policy, and then the plaintiffs must show a less discriminatory alternative. None of these elements require individual proof. Now, my friend on the other side mentioned uninjured class members and saying that the District Court had wrongly assumed that a statutory violation of the Fair Housing Act gave class members an injury. And this goes to your question, Judge Griffin. This court has held in Merck versus Walmart that the harm of racial discrimination under the Fair Housing Act is a cognizable injury that confers standing. It was very clear. It described how the harms that violate the Fair Housing Act, unlike harms under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, can give standing for Article III purposes. So every class member here has standing. That's not a concern. And the District Court did recognize this in its opinion when it said proposed class members have suffered the same injury, the imposition of the allegedly discriminatory water lien. In addition, every class member has the injury of having a lien placed on their property, an encumbrance made on their property that authorizes the government to seize that property and sell that property if they don't pay up. This more than satisfies the low bar for standing, which the Supreme Court has held is only need be, the harm need only be an identifiable trifle to be considered an Article III injury. So this is not a case where we have concerns that there are many uninjured class members. All of the class suffered an injury that is traceable to the placement of the lien. Turning to the scope of the Fair Housing Act itself, this statute's broad and inclusive text, Congress's intent, and cases from this court and other circuits show that the placement of a lien, which sets in motion a process that can result in home loss, and greatly increases the risk that that foreclosure will indeed result, falls within the statute's otherwise make unavailable language. But as you inquired, Judge Clay, that question does not need to be decided at this juncture. We're here on a class certification appeal, and it's not necessary to answer the question about the scope of 3604A in order to certify the class or to affirm the class certification. Every class member here had a lien placed on their property. So every class member has the same question, whether the placement of that lien is actionable under the statute. That question predominates throughout the class and does not require any in consideration of individual circumstances. And so it's not necessary for this court to delve into the merits that go to that question because it can be answered on a class-wide basis. This is a fundamental point that Cleveland fails to grapple with. Their attacks here are essentially collateral attacks on the District Court's summary judgment decision. That decision contained 28 pages of analysis of the Fair Housing Act, relying both on legal analysis and the factual record in this case. That decision, however, is not on appeal before this court today. And much of their arguments quarrel with the analysis that is in the summary judgment opinion. Nevertheless, I'm happy to delve into the merits of the Fair Housing Act in more detail. This court in the Babin case emphasized that Congress intended Section 3604 to reach a broad range of activities that have the effect of denying housing opportunities. And it held that conduct that makes housing unavailable within the meaning of the Fair Housing Act is that which directly affects the availability of housing. Water liens directly affect the ability of someone to retain their home in at least two ways. they greatly increase the risk that a foreclosure will result. The record here shows that residential properties with a water lien end in foreclosure 17% of the time. Residential properties without a water lien only 1.1% of the time. The imposition of a water lien also triggers penalties and interest that make it more expensive for that homeowner to avoid foreclosure because they have to pay off not only the underlying lien but also the penalties and interest in order to save their home from foreclosure. In these respects, water liens are similar to many other practices that courts recognize make housing unavailable under the Fair Housing Act because they can trigger or lead to home loss. Now, Cleveland says that only conduct that interferes with possession or immediately triggers home loss is cognizable under the statute, but that goes against what this court held in the Cisneros case. That case concerned the cancellation and non-renewal of homeowners insurance, and the court held that that was cognizable under 3604A because it could lead to home loss, even though it didn't immediately trigger that result. The Seventh Circuit held the same in the United Farm Bureau case. Other circuits have also followed this principle in holding that, for example, threats of eviction that do not actually result in an eviction down the line do fall within the make unavailable language. And a number of district courts have found that predatory lending, for example, home equity, home improvement, or debt consolidation loans that are secured by the property also fall within the make unavailable standard because they place a person at risk of losing that home. Babin cautioned that the conduct at issue cannot be too attenuated in order to fall within the make unavailable standard. But that's not the case we have here. Imposition of a water lien is not an attenuated or remote factor in whether a person ultimately may lose their home. Rather, it's the catalyst. It is the instrument that transforms a mere debt, an unpaid water bill, into an encumbrance on your property that authorizes the county to come in and foreclose on the home. So that's how it has a direct effect on the availability of the home. The standard here is not interference with possession. My friend on the other side mentioned a case from the District of Vermont. That case is in the constitutional takings arena, not a Fair Housing Act case. And there's no case law here that says we should read the Fair Housing Act relying on analysis in the takings doctrine. It's a completely separate doctrine that requires dispossession, deprivation of housing, or a physical invasion on someone's property, and that is simply not the standard for make unavailable under the Fair Housing Act. I'd like to turn to the actual text for a moment. The key language here, otherwise make unavailable or deny, it's important that we give all of those words meaning. And first, controlling precedent says that the language in the Fair Housing Act must be given a generous construction and is broad and inclusive. So looking at that language, we have to give all those words such a construction. The word otherwise indicates that the Fair Housing Act reaches conduct that may go beyond that interferes with the sale or rental of a property. It's a catch-all phrase that broadens the scope of that provision. And the words or deny make clear that this section prohibits both conduct that makes unavailable and conduct that denies housing. Those two terms must be given different constructions in order for one of them to not be surplusage. And so make unavailable encompasses conduct that may fall short of the actual denial of housing. And it is broad enough here to include the imposition of a water lien. I'd like to turn to an issue that was brought up in the order granting the 23F petition, because I think it's important to highlight here. And that was the concern that this case would open the floodgates to litigation against municipal liens. This case does not challenge all municipal liens. The facts here related to Cleveland's water liens show that it falls well within the scope of 3604A because of the particularly harsh way that Cleveland's water lanes operate. They can be placed for a very low amount of unpaid amount of outstanding water charges, as low as $300. Cleveland has very stringent requirements to get on a payment plan in order to avoid the lien, requiring that someone pay usually about half of the outstanding balance before being granted a payment plan.
Do we really have to get into that? Aren't we focusing on whether the common interests of the class members predominate such that they're entitled to compose a class for purposes of bringing a class action? We don't have to get into what you're talking about now, do we?
That's absolutely right, Judge Clay. I don't think that any of these factual distinctions are appropriate for the court to delve into right now. They go to the merits of the claim. They are addressed in detail in the summary judgment decision by the district court. But you are correct. We don't need to analyze this Fair Housing Act question about the scope, about whether the scope applies to Cleveland's water liens, because that is a question that will apply uniformly to the class. It is an important question in the case, but it is a question that is the same for all class members, and that goes to show that issues, legal issues and factual issues, predominate for the class.
And this appeal is about whether the district court correctly certified the class. That's really the only thing that's before the court on appeal, is it not?
That is correct. It's only whether the district court properly found that the requirements of Rule 23 were satisfied. The only requirement that Cleveland has disputed here is the predominance requirement. And as mentioned, the key issue of whether water liens fall within the scope of the Fair Housing Act is common. The key analysis of the disparate impact elements is common across the class. So that predominance finding by the district court was proper. There's no question here that those issues predominate. There's no question that the class members all have an injury here, and that the district court was correct to certify the class. And if the court has no further questions.
I have none.
Oh.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. We'll have a rebuttal.
Your Honors, Ms. Holmes started off today by trying to answer your question, Judge Griffin, about whether a violation of the Fair Housing Act could be the standing issue, could be the injury itself that satisfies the Rule 23b3 predominance. Even taking her answer as correct, I think that underscores the need to address the scope question, because there is no standing for a violation of the Fair Housing Act if this is not a Fair Housing Act case. And I think that's why...
You're familiar with our case, Merrick versus Walmart, that she cited. It's a Sixth Circuit case from 2024.
Yes, Your Honor. But I don't believe that pertains at all to the actual scope issues here.
Well, at page 779, we stated, plaintiffs under the Fair Housing Act have standing under Article 3 because Congress identified and elevated an individual harm, private discrimination in the housing market on the basis of race. That harm is comparable to the harm found in the Constitution, racial discrimination by the government. I mean, doesn't that just say that plaintiffs in a fair housing case have standing? And that's what we have here, isn't it?
I think it still poses questions of how a 23B3 class requires damages, and it's still not clear to me.
Well, at this point, don't we accept the allegations contained in the complaint?
Not at the class certification stage, Your Honor, because while there might be, I'll agree with Ms. Holmes that questions about individualized damages are appropriate for later on in the case. That initial fact of damage question does have to be analyzed as part of the predominance. But having said that, Your Honor, Merck only comes into play if this is a Fair Housing Act case, if there has been a Fair Housing Act violation.
Well, I know, but that's a factual issue, isn't it? That's down the road. That goes to the merits. I think we all agreed that we are not deciding the merits of this case. We're only deciding whether the certification of this class can proceed so they can litigate. their allegations. And, I mean, isn't that right?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think it mixes up a little bit the status of how the court approached certification. We're not early in this case. Discovery is concluded. Summary judgment and class certification were briefed at the same time. There was a full record for Judge Oliver when he was making his certification decision. And when he decided to address the certify a damages class under Rule 23b3, he said that the basis for finding a Fair Housing Act damages class was his finding that the assessment makes housing unavailable. So I think that presents squarely the legal question of how...
Even if his rationale is wrong, I mean, it's the result that we review, and we don't reverse because his rationale is wrong. I mean, I think it's quite clear that they allege a Fair Housing Act violation, that they have standing to litigate that and to proceed and find out whether it's true or not. That's all.
Your Honor, at this stage of the case, they may have alleged a Fair Housing Act violation, but to certify a class based on a finding that the assessment of liens make housing unavailable under Section 3604A.
We just don't know that. I don't know that either. And they say because it's such a low threshold of $300 and that you could lose your house by not paying $300, that's going to make housing unavailable. And, you know, it's got to be litigated.
These questions about threshold, Judge Griffin, are ultimately fact questions.
Sure.
That are apart from the answer of whether a lien, a statutory lien, that it's undisputed creates no ownership or possessory interest, actually makes it unavailable, which is a threshold question of law under interpretation of the Fair Housing Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Both sides are well argued. The case is submitted.